This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong is one of the most important books in the trumpet's literature library. This book gives an overview of the decline and fall prophesied to happen to these nations in the time just ahead, and we see so many of these prophecies happening right now. One of the things that causes some people to discount what is written in that book is just how powerful America's military is today. A lot of people can't imagine that this nation could go down given just how strong our armed forces are, how well-funded, how technologically advanced we are. But in our first segment, we're going to talk about why America's trust in its military is misplaced. This past week, Hurricane Matthew didn't do as much damage to the U.S. as some forecasts predicted, but it really hit some areas in the Caribbean quite hard, especially Haiti. We're going to talk about just how bad the damage was down there and why it's important for us not to get too tunnel-visioned about tragedy, to remember just how many parts of the world are suffering today. In our third segment, we're going to go behind the scenes in our trumpet production and talk to artist Gary Dorning, the man behind many of the trumpet's iconic cover paintings and the illustrations in the magazine. He's going to tell you some dirty secrets about what it's like to have to work with a guy like me who gives him impossible stories to illustrate under deadlines that are far too short, yet somehow he manages to produce work of amazing quality. Really interesting interview with one of our coworkers here. And I'll conclude the program by talking about a stealth missile that the media aims at our sons. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The United States of America has the world's most powerful, well-funded, technologically advanced military in the world. There's a lot of fatigue in America today about the seemingly endless wars that we've had going on in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and elsewhere. And you really see a lot of push for a more isolationist policy in this presidential election cycle especially. But still, Americans put a lot of trust in our military to keep us safe as the world continues to get more dangerous. Is this trust well placed? I have Trumpet contributing editor Philip Nice here in the studio to talk about this. Hello, Phil.
Hello.
Good to have you here. So I'd like to start by just talking about how massive the military is. You've done quite a bit of research about this.
Yes, we all know that the United States military is the most powerful in the world, the most powerful in world history, in fact. And it's a well-known fact that we have multiples of other nations' militaries. You have to multiply some of the other militaries, first world militaries, to equal the United States. And what's interesting about this, what kind of got me thinking about it, is right here where we are now in the Trumpet offices, very frequently you can go outside, and whether you're walking to lunch or walking to your car or over to the auditorium, you can look up and see a symbol of this might, of this power, and it's an airplane. It's called the E-3 Sentry, and it's based in Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma City. And it's the one perhaps you've seen with a large radar dish on top of it. It's a commercial jet-sized airplane that carries a radar dish. And Tinker has 32 of these. The rest of the world has right about 32. That's not to say that there aren't Russian versions of this plane, but that gives you kind of an indication of how the U.S. stacks up. The Sentry is really an interesting plane. It's kind of the big eye of the Air Force. It has a radar look-down capability, which means that it can look down toward the ground and filter out all the chaff to find the planes, the ships, the things that are moving. on the ground. Because normally if you point a radar at the ground, you just get a whole bunch of reflection and you can't see anything. But this has a basically a supercomputer inside of it. So that's the E3 Sentry, kind of a, and that's the probably one of the least glamorous planes that's even at Tinker Air Force Base. Huh. There's the E3, which basically does the same thing for tanks. So the Sentry does the ships and the planes. The E3 can do tanks. The E8, the E8 is the E3 for tanks. I should say there's the C-17 down there, famous cargo plane that can carry more than 100 paratroopers or 10 Humvees or even a main battle tank. And there's also the B-52, kind of a famous workhorse bomber, and a lot of other planes down there that just kind of are a symbol of America's war fighting power.
And we're talking about one airbase. I mean, Tinker is a big air base, but there's quite a few. How many, say, in the United States that this would be representative of?
Oh, there are. It's, you can spend hours researching it and not fully be able to answer that question. There are so many bases, so many Air National Guard bases. There's obviously Air Force bases. There's joint bases all over the United States and all over the world. We have 150,000 troops stationed all over the world. So this is the air power, part of the air power at a base that you've probably never heard of. And just down the road, just down the interstate in Missouri, we have the an Air Force base that launches the famous stealth bomber. And this is probably one of the more glamorous symbols of America's power, something that no other nation has. And you can take off from Missouri, from, you know, Midwestern United States, in a stealth bomber, refuel with a KC-135 a couple or three or four times, bomb a cave in Afghanistan, and then fly back home. So you've entered enemy airspace, but you've never touched down. Uh-huh. Typically, they will actually touch down at a base in the Indian Ocean on the way home. But these guys sleep in their beds at their house at night, and they are engaging enemies in a cave and, you know, on the other side of the world. So
gives you an idea of just how amazing the technological capacity is of the United States. And this is what all of those military dollars will buy you. If you have that to spend, this is what you can end up being able to do. And there are a lot of, this has been really in a lot of ways kind of one of the dominant geopolitical realities for the last several decades, even going back to World War II, the fact that the United States has had these kinds of capabilities.
Yeah, that's right. I just, in researching for the article for the Trumpet, I kind of do a comparison. And like I said, it's hard to even find all the numbers for the military for obvious reasons. But if you take some of the most generally used numbers, and depending on how you count superiority, you can't obviously just count numbers. Like if you have more planes than another nation that you're militarily superior. But if you take all those things into account, you can say that the United States Air Force is far and away the most powerful air power in the world. It has the F-22, the most powerful, most advanced fighter jet. There aren't even other nations don't even have planes in the same generation as this plane. Obviously the stealth that we talked about, you have the F-35 Lightning II, which, despite all its problems, is a fairly advanced... I mean, it is an advanced jet, and we have hundreds of them. And that would outmatch Russia and China combined. Now, Russia and China have different defense realities, and so, again, the comparison is a little bit general, but that's the United States Air Force. Now, the second most powerful air power in the world is the United States Navy. Mm-hmm. And it has hundreds of fighters, the Hornet, the Super Hornet, Fighting Falcon, all these airplanes that could go up again against any other nation's air force, and can, because it's on air force bases that float on the water and go to the enemy.
Right.
I have a graphic here that I'm looking at of the United States aircraft carriers from globalsecurity.org, and it counts our helicopter carriers as well. So the United States has has 10 nuclear aircraft carriers. Then it has 9 smaller carriers. The rest of the world combined has...
Counting this up on the page.
12.
Okay.
12 aircraft carriers compared to the United States. So it's a massive air power of its own. And then if you want to be creative, you could count the United States Marine Corps as another one of the world's top air powers. And that's not even its main job.
Right.
to be an air power. Now, it does have fighters and so forth, but...
So the reason why this is interesting to look at these numbers is you're talking about the kind of military superiority that the United States enjoys over every other nation. And yet, when you look at the geopolitical realities of what we see happening in the world today, the United States is proving itself really quite ineffective in a number of theaters. This is something that we've talked about quite a lot. Its influence in Asia is diminishing. Its influence in Europe is diminishing. In the Middle East, it's diminishing. And so despite the numerical or even superiority that it enjoys in reality, when you're talking about effectiveness, when you're talking about actual power projection, you don't see a trend commensurate with the numbers that you're talking about there. And so there are a lot of reasons why this is the case, but like what we were talking about at the beginning, the kind of trust that America tends to put in its military, it does. There really are some larger questions here that we need to be concerned about. How much of, like, say, out of the reasons why you would have to look at all of that and put kind of an asterisk next to it. What do you think are some of the ones of greatest concern?
Well, that's just the point. You could, first of all, as the average American, you wake up in the morning in some way entrusting the fact that you do wake up in the morning to the United States military. We do trust the military to protect us from other militaries and other countries that would do us harm. So we do put our trust in the military, and that would be one thing if the military was proving effective for all the investment, for all the just the huge financial drain that it is. But as you bring up, it's not proving itself effective. It's not proving to have the same type of effect that all of its capabilities technologically, that all of its numerical comparisons would tend to give you. So it does bring up some questions. Why is that? Why doesn't it work that if you spend $682 billion on your military, like we did in 2012, and the rest of the first world, basically, of the largest military spends less than that, the next 10 nations spend $652 billion. So why is it that if you spend more money than the next 10 nations combined, you get more security? Why is it that if you develop superior technologies, you're still struggling against second world nations?
Right. They're finding some really interesting ways to kind of neutralize some of that technological superiority and to find workarounds and that eliminate some of that advantage in really cheap and effective ways. That we see that happening quite a lot, you know, in a lot of different areas.
Right, and that's the fundamental question: Can a aircraft carrier outlast an anti-ship missile? You know, will a nation like China be able to develop a missile that can hit a carrier faster than we can develop faster carriers or faster, better countermeasures or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's just the thing is the question that I would like to ask in the article is, can nuclear super carriers carry the day? Can a super large, super advanced Air Force carry the day? Can our military as a whole continue to carry the day indefinitely?
Right.
You know, will this just go on forever? Will we keep spending money, even if we have to borrow it? Will we keep burning oil at, you know, huge amounts? Will we keep feeding resources and our own trust into this machine indefinitely, and we'll just always be safe? You know, the question that I ask is, you know, how could the U.S. military ever fall? And just looking at it from more of a historical perspective, the real question is, how can it not? How can anything go on indefinitely, go on forever, especially with all the problems that are plaguing us, and with so much at stake, with the level of destructiveness that weapons have in our arsenal and in the arsenals of other countries.
Right, and also just the seeming rise in will on the part of many of these other nations as they detect that weakness in the United States, or that that inability to effectively marshal that power. They see an opening and seem more and more willing to kind of step into the breach there. And so as you see them rising and making decisions, Russia, China, Iran, making decisions that really do reflect their understanding of the way that the way the wind is blowing in the world today, what can the United States do to counteract that? I think all of this, it's an interesting subject to study. We've talked about several aspects of it in terms of failed technologies that we've invested a whole lot in, equipment, weapons that have we've, you know, put a lot of stock in, and because of some malfunction, bad manufacturing, or of stealth chips by Chinese manufacturers being installed in our equipment, all kinds of things, money misspent in areas that you know, show a great deal of corruption on the part of military leaders. There's a whole lot of things behind it, but ultimately, it seems like there's this problem of just what the decision makers are doing with that power, that they're failing to actually step up and, you know, bring those capacities to bear on the problems that are besieging the world today.
And that's just the point. The power and effectiveness and your own personal safety and the safety of your family have to depend on something besides military spending, besides a technological breakthrough, besides these almost godlike powers that the military is trying to develop, seeing, you know, people from outer space and striking them from drones and so forth. The point that I think is really intriguing to think about is there something else that our personal safety depends on besides the United States military? And that includes people in other countries. One of the reasons that right. the United States military is so big is because those other countries have effectively outsourced their own protection to us. So more than just Americans, but people in other countries are trusting that whatever happens, we have got the nukes and they have not, you know.
Right.
But we're already seeing that that's not enough. There's something else that you have to have. And if you put all your trust in the military, you're putting all your trust in being able to sustain this machine indefinitely. And I think there's just a fundamental problem with that. And that's what the article looks at.
We've been talking with Trumpet contributing editor Philip Nice. He's working on an article on the U.S. military and our trust in the technology of the military for the next print edition. And it's obviously a fascinating subject that covers a whole lot of ground. There's a lot of different facets of this, but it really does point to those fundamental prophecies in the Bible that we talk about that Herbert W. Armstrong covered in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. And you look at the preponderance of power that the military enjoys today, and it almost forces you to ask the question, how could such a powerful country fall the way that the Bible says that it will? So some of these fundamental questions that you're asking in here, I think they really are just foundational to our appreciation for how those prophecies will be fulfilled. Well, we appreciate that. We look forward to reading the article, Phil, and thanks for your time.
Good to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This past week, Hurricane Matthew ripped through Haiti, Jamaica, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, and the Bahamas before it hit the southeastern United States. Weather forecasts predicted that this Category 5 storm could do tremendous damage in the United States, but it ended up not being as catastrophic as some expected. It left some commentators saying that America dodged a bullet. But we want to take some time to look at the true impact of this storm, even beyond America's shores. It's easy for Americans particularly to get tunnel visioned and not really care too much about some of the poorer areas that are devastated by storms such as this one. I have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques here in the studio to talk about this. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello, it's good to be here.
So let's just start by tracking where Hurricane Matthew went and the damage that it wreaked along that route.
Okay, sure. Yeah, as you said, here in the U.S., we kind of have the feeling that we dodged the bullet with the storm. It was devastating in some areas. There were actually 21 Americans killed by it from falling trees, from vehicle-related fatalities that resulted from the storm conditions. And then there are over 1 million people in the U.S. left without power. And estimates indicate that total economic losses are probably between $4 to $5 billion in the southeastern U.S. So that's certainly not insignificant. But as you said, on the whole, it didn't really live up to the dire predictions that were being issued before it struck. And its devastation in the U.S. just wasn't nearly as catastrophic as we feared that it would be. But in Haiti, especially, Hurricane Matthew was terribly devastating. And as you mentioned there, it can be pretty easy for us to begin to get a little bit numb or calloused about devastation that happens in countries that we view as kind of irrelevant and in countries that are very poor. But, you know, those are men and women and children with the exact same potential that anyone in America has. And in Haiti, there were hundreds of thousands of them whose lives were just utterly torn apart by this storm. As of last night, there were at least 1,000 Haitians confirmed to have been killed, and that number is really rapidly rising as more and more data comes in. And about 90% of Haiti's south faced complete destruction, according to aid workers in the area. Right now, there are aid workers and locals working around the clock to pull survivors out of the rubble, where houses and buildings were flattened and fell on top of families. It was, it was a Category 4 storm when it hit Haiti south, and it had wind speeds of up to 230 miles per hour when it hit those areas. I've got a quote here from one man named Jean-Pierre Jean Donald, who was rescued from the rubble. He said, "The entire house fell on us. I couldn't get out. People finally came to lift the rubble, and that's when we saw my wife who had died." And then here's another quote from a resident around the same area. I didn't get this man's name, but he says, "God gives and God takes. Mankind, for all the evil he does, could never do something like this." Pretty sobering quote there. And then here's another one from Kate Corrigan. She's a nurse working with a charity in the area called Innovating Health International. And she said, "What we've seen thus far has been a fairly large spread destruction in the south, potentially at points of 90% destruction in some locations, complete destruction in those locations." And then she said that it's many small towns that remain almost entirely inaccessible. because of the storm. And that's why they expect the death toll to keep on climbing as they're able to get into these smaller inaccessible areas and just sort of take account of the carnage there. But altogether, though, officials estimate that about 500,000 people, 500,000 people in Haiti are now stranded, and the majority of those may be homeless. Uh-huh. So it's just quite a lot of people whose lives were totally devastated.
Yeah,
by
it's
this.
Hard to even wrap your mind around those kinds of numbers. And so much of the time when these types of events happen, you know, it's hitting these areas where because the structures aren't as durable and they're more susceptible to being destroyed by these kinds of devastating winds or floods or the kind of natural phenomena that tend to strike. It does a lot more damage in an area like this than it would if it were to hit a comparably populated area with stronger structures. And so you tend to see these kinds of numbers in these more impoverished areas.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This was particularly devastating to Haiti because it is one of the world's poorest countries. And also, Haiti has never even fully recovered from the earthquake in 2010 that right. hit there. That killed, I think the most commonly agreed upon number is 160,000 people that died directly in the earthquake. Yeah. And then there was a terrible outbreak of cholera that happened because of the circumstances created in the aftermath of that earthquake. So these are people who have really, really suffered. And then here comes Hurricane Matthew to kind of re-destroy all of what so many of them had been trying to rebuild in the last 5-6 years there. So it is a really sobering event that happened there, and it's something that you know, I think we should just really expect more and more of this kind of thing also going forward.
I was actually for something I was studying into recently, looking at a United Nations Development Report from 2010, and just looking at some of the it was just describing several events that have caused suffering in the world. And just that year, 2010, they said that the number of people who died or were made homeless because of natural disasters just in that year was 3.38 million people.
Wow.
So there's the scale of how much these disasters tend to affect people. We look at a situation like this that was quite severe. The United States comes away with only 21 people who have died, and kind of think, well, yeah, that was nice that we didn't have any worse. And it is. I mean, you would hate to see high death tolls anywhere like that. But that shocked me because we tend to think of see death tolls more in the realm of dozens of people, but in so many of these areas, it really is like you were talking about how many hundreds of thousands were affected or were made homeless potentially just because of this one hurricane. But you know, that UN report actually, out of all of the things that it listed, it talked about how many people were affected, how many people were killed in civil wars. There were over 103,000 people who were killed in civil wars, 25.3 million people who were pushed out of their homes because of a war within countries, 12.8 million refugees driven from their country just in 1 year. Like these natural disasters are really only one cause of tremendous suffering that you see happening in so many countries in the world.
Yeah, and I think it's important for anyone who wants to have a realistic worldview to take a look at those kinds of stories, even when they happen far from home, even when they happen in a nation that you feel is not at all connected to your life. Because in the U.S., we do feel pretty insulated from a lot of that. We're still living in times that are quite prosperous, and because of advanced technological practices and whatnot, as you said, we're insulated from all but the very worst of weather disasters, where we've, you know, learned how to build structures that can withstand the brunt of it. We haven't experienced civil wars of the kind that you're talking about on a broad scale, at least. But if you really want to remember what's happening globally and what the world is like, then these kinds of things are important to keep in mind, really.
Right. Another aspect of that report that just stunned me. Well, I guess it wasn't that report, actually. I was just looking at just broadly what is happening in the world today just with respect to warfare. And right now, there are wars going on in four nations, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Nigeria, that have killed at least 10,000 people just this year in 2016. The first 9-10 months of 2016. 10,000 people have died. 55,000 people have died just in Syria this year. And there are also wars in several other nations that have killed at least 2,000 people this year. Mexico, Yemen, Pakistan, Ukraine, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, Egypt, and Libya. 2,000 casualties just this year. When I look at those kinds of statistics, and just think, like you said, if you're just casting your mind outside of the borders of the United States and recognizing how many people in the world are experiencing severe trauma and suffering, it just makes what we see happening in the United States presidential election that much more obscene in a lot of ways. The fact that the kinds of issues that we're preoccupied with in this nation, as we ignore the scale of the problems and the suffering that are happening elsewhere.
Yeah, it really is shocking to see how insular a lot of the focus of the political discourse has become. It's all about what's happening within our borders, really petty issues. One politician, decrying the poor choices of the other, and things that on a global scale are... It's just embarrassing for that to be the fixation of so much of the discourse. But we are beginning to see that those problems from other nations are leaking into our country. They're crossing our borders in a lot of cases. We see Islamic attacks happening from time to time, and all kinds of immigration problems and things like that. So ignoring what's happening outside of the U.S. doesn't prevent it from affecting us.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I think, I do wonder how much just in living in the world of CNN and the scroll going across the bottom of the screen and 24/7 internet news coverage, and how easy it is for us to have access to information about what's going on elsewhere. And it seems like there's a real strong tendency in human nature to want to kind of tune that out and just focus on, say, sports and gossip and things that, I don't know. It seems like the human mind just really wants to gravitate toward nonsensical or things that just aren't as aren't assaulting you and giving you this sense of like the world is spinning out of control, that type of thing. But like you said, even those areas they're tending to get more influenced by some of the problems socially and even geopolitically.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right. And even when these devastating things happen in Haiti and elsewhere, we still try to pool our resources and send volunteer groups there and to pump a lot of foreign aid money into it. It does affect us here, and it is an interconnected world. So these are important stories, even if they feel a little bit far flung at first look, for us to keep in mind, I think.
I'm just reminded of a passage in the book of Matthew where Jesus Christ was standing. There was a group of people around him, and he looked and he said that these people were like sheep without a shepherd, and he was moved with compassion on them, and he told his disciples, the harvest is ripe, but the laborers are few, and said, pray therefore the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth more laborers into the harvest. And that big picture mindset that he had, that was basically fueled by compassion for the people who were in such need, and funneling that effort into supporting the work of God, there's just something fundamentally very important about that, and particularly as we see the suffering increasing in so many areas in the world today, and people seem less and less concerned about those things, for us to keep that in mind and to think the way that Jesus Christ did, with, you know, having that kind of compassion and recognizing that all of those folks, that if we were in their position, we would want to be helped. We would want, we would need hope. We would need to be taken care of in some ways. That really is, that's the way that God thinks. That's the way that we need to think.
Yeah. And as you said, it's not our natural tendency. Our natural tendency is to, you know, we seek entertainment. We seek smooth things to be told things that are, you know, maybe interesting and whatnot. We don't naturally gravitate our attention toward all these catastrophes happening, but with some effort, I think it's a very worthwhile thing to try to just stay apprised of all that.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about natural disasters and suffering in the world today. If you want a more in-depth look at what the Bible says about this subject and why these things happen and why God would even allow suffering to happen on the scale of what we see in so many countries today, like what happened in Haiti after Hurricane Matthew ripped through there, I would encourage you to go online to thetrumpet.com. We have a literature area. You can just see the literature tab at the top of the website there and find the booklet, Why Natural Disasters. It's a fairly large book. It's free. You can download it. You can order a free copy of it. We'd be happy to send it to you. But it really does explain why these events are happening with increasing frequency and how you can explain that from a biblical standpoint. Why would God allow these things to happen, and what is his expectation of us as we see these occurring before our eyes? Why Natural Disasters? You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Well, thanks for your time, Jeremiah. It's a good conversation to bring into the Trumpet Hour.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
If you've been reading the Trumpet News Magazine for any length of time, you have seen the artwork of my next guest, Gary Dorning. We've just finished our November-December edition, and our cover story is by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, and the title of the article is The Spirit of Charlemagne is Alive in Europe. So if you, dear listener, were the artist for the trumpet and you were given an article by that title, how would you illustrate this for the cover of the Trumpet magazine? Well, Gary painted Charlemagne surveying a globe with Europe there prominently at the top. It's really a very striking image. It's one of many that he's done for us over the last few years. We have Gary in the studio here to tell us about what it's like to be in the world of painting the Trumpet magazine. How are you doing, Gary?
I'm good. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. Yeah. It's been a long time coming. I've wanted to do this for quite a while, but why don't you start by just telling us a bit about yourself as an artist, your background and your experiences?
Well, I think the the main point I would like to make to people that don't know about me is that I come from a fine arts background. And so with fine arts, you're kind of doing artwork for the sake of the art, and it's a way of looking at it. Like I would be doing images that were I would sell just because it was the image I wanted to do, so it became its own product. And I was involved in wildlife art, mostly oil painting and scrimshaw, which is ivory engraving. And so for the bulk of my career, it's been doing work for its own sake, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
And commercial art takes a different sort of skew to that. So my background is technically, I think, has lent itself to this, technically. But I've definitely had to go through my own, like, balancing act in trying to get the idea of commercial art correct.
Right. You know, yeah, so you've got somebody who's coming at you and handing an article to you or saying, I want an image of this type, it's got to be this way, and then giving you a lot of feedback.
Yes.
Sometimes quite a lot of feedback. No, it's got to be this way or that way.
Yes.
So pretty big change from what you were doing initially. But maybe you could just explain what you mean. Technically, that background has kind of equipped you with the tools that you need in order to do what you're doing.
Well, I've been involved in image making since I was in kindergarten. So I've been involved in color composition, all of the things that you need, I was well versed in.
Yeah.
And that's never been the problem for me. Like I've always considered myself a good image maker, you know. But here's something that's really fascinating. About 10 years before I got hired here, I had a client of mine back in Bellingham who was a collector, but he also owned a giant tool company, wanted me to do his catalog cover. And I couldn't figure out why. Like, I don't really fit that kind of idea. I did it. I'm still doing it. I've done it 12 years, 13 years in a row. Well, I look back now and I realize that God was really helping me to gear my mind toward doing an image for a client quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And starting to learn to look at it from their point of view. Mm-hmm. And that's really the issue. You know, like I said, I think I'm qualified technically. My weakness would be trying to take your point of view as an editor, for instance, and to see the work from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And then let that dictate what the image is going to be, rather than just thinking, this is what looks cool, which has always been my default. This is what looks really good, therefore it's got to work. And now it's not quite like that. It's more complicated than that.
Yeah, so that makes perfect sense. And you're kind of looking at it from two different standpoints. One is to try to see what the finished product needs to be through the eyes of, say, the editor or the content. You're trying to illustrate something that already exists. And I'd like to explore that a little bit more, but then maybe we could also just talk about the deadline side of things, because if I understand right, if you're working on something for just for fine art purposes, you're kind of your own, there really isn't necessarily a hard deadline as far as that goes. And so you can kind of keep working on it until you feel like, okay, I'm ready to move on to something else.
Yeah, that's...
That's not the case at all.
No.
When you're working on a magazine.
The story of my career is having that. Now, granted, you could have deadlines and you could have shows and you could have... But those were, frankly, they were pretty rare. It was generally speaking, in fact, my motto to myself was, I work on this until I'm done.
Yeah.
And that's good and bad, but whatever, that was where I was coming from. It was do the image all the way. And that was the goal. The quality was absolutely paramount. That's all I cared about, was what it looked like. That's really paid off for me, to have a discipline and to have a kind of a perfectionist level standard.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also been one of the things I've had to wrestle to the ground. You mentioned deadlines. I mean, that's like, I get a deadline a week, a day, 2 days,
yeah.
And it's...
No, a day. Have we ever done that?
No,
I think
you
we do.
You
we
wouldn't
do.
Think
we,
of doing that.
We do
so.
Do that too often. Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's like looking at it, and then I look at the deadline, I look at the piece that you're asking me to do or somebody's asking me to do, and I simply have to fit it into that parameter. And that's the end of it. When the deadline comes, it's finished. And so it's been a change of mind for me, and I've had to rely on God a lot. You know, I pray a lot for help, because I will look at something sometimes and go, I'll be thinking, I just don't know exactly how to do this. I don't, and then I'll find a way. It just works. But it can be nerve-wracking at times, but it's still... I think it's interesting when you have a deadline that can sometimes actually be very positive.
Yeah.
Giving yourself a limited amount of time forces you to work in a way that is, you're completely focused on finishing the piece. Sometimes when you're given carte blanche, that can actually be a negative and you can find yourself spinning,
yeah.
You know, and it's really easy to do that. You just kind of find yourself, you're working, but maybe not that effectively, you know? So,
yeah, absolutely. I think any artist, I mean, that's something that you find really right across the board. And even in writing that you, it's very important to kind of define your parameters and get, set some restraints on yourself and kind of even create some rules for yourself to operate within,
yeah.
Just to give structure to the work that you're doing.
Yeah. And if you're self-employed or you're doing your own artwork, that's entirely on you. You just absolutely have to come to a place where you say, this is how I work. And you have to be a certain kind of person to pull that off. You have to be self-driven, but you also have to have a certain discipline in order to wrestle that to the ground. And sometimes I didn't do it very well. I took a long time. Thankfully, the work always was good enough. So, but I would look back sometimes and go, I could have done that in half the time.
Mm.
And it's always been that. I can do this in much shorter time. One of the things that bothers me is if I'm given a deadline that I think is too short and then it works, that can really bother me because then I'm thinking, well, then why, you know, maybe I need that all the time. I'm not saying that, but you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it can make you wonder, like maybe the deadline has its own energy and positive point to it. It can be too short though. And there, you know, there's obviously a point where it becomes too short and you don't get to do it the way you maybe envision.
Right.
But it is what it is. You know,
right.
we're all in that boat. So yeah. I'm not the only one, that's for sure. So,
well, I have to say, we've still got a little bit more time, but here's my little Gary Dorning love segment. I'm amazed at how much you have adapted to the environment that we like and the demands of Trumpet Magazine production and the kinds of images that we're getting on really compressed time scale. I mean, we do try to give you as much lead time as we can, but it's amazing to me how the quality of what you have been able to, it just disciplining yourself basically to produce in really tight time constraints, something that is really outstanding. I mean, when I look over some of the images that you've made for us, I just think, you know, I know the circumstances under which they were created, and I'm thinking, well, this is really outstanding. This new trumpet cover is one of those that I don't think that we had the idea for exactly how we could illustrate this until really quite late in the process. So it amazes me what you've been able to do, and considering how different it was from what you were doing before. What do you feel like have been some of the biggest challenges in kind of taking that transformation in your mindset as an artist?
I think just in a general way, kind of what I'd said before, it's the idea that I have to come up with something. Maybe actually when I think about it, probably the biggest challenge is to really look at, for instance, a cover or an article and to try to understand what the purpose of it is. It's different than it used to be. You know, it's so different. I know I'm kind of repeating myself, but this is the biggest challenge for me, is to grasp the fact that I have to get out of the way. It's not about me. See, and when I was doing my work before, it was, you know, I don't mean this in a bad way, but it was all about me. I'm the artist. I'm doing it. They're buying my work, you know, blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right.
I have to completely get out of the way. I'm not important in this. And that is an odd kind of thing for me to think about, because the artwork has to be the highest quality I can make it. So it has nothing to do with quality, but it has to do with getting out of the way and recognizing that I'm representing a product, the
yeah.
trumpet.
Yeah.
You know, you're representing a product. We're representing a product. We're representing a message. We're representing whatever it is. So I always have to do that. And if it doesn't, you know, That's been the biggest challenge, to
yeah.
wrap my mind around the purpose of this thing I'm doing now, which is completely different than what it was before,
yeah.
you know? That's it.
Yeah, that's outstanding. That's very interesting. So looking at things from maybe more of a technical standpoint, you've made changes even in the way that you work. You've gotten into using the computer. You were using oils and messy type tools before. Now you're, you know, you're clicking pixels on a screen and so on. What stylistically, if you went from more wildlife painting to now having to do Charlemagne and you're painting a lot more people, I think probably the best cover right up there at the top or near the top is the one that you did in the January 2016 edition where you had President Obama flanked by Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi and Bernie Sanders. That was like, it looked like a movie poster. You know, it had this sort of crime drama, sort of film noir flavor to it. Stylistically, what have been some of the challenges and maybe exciting things about a new vistas that you've had to explore?
Well, in a way, you know, the thing about style I find is interesting. And I remember an artist mentioning this. I don't remember which one, but he's a very famous artist. He said that style comes. You don't have to think about it so much. If you don't think about it and don't worry about it, your personality will then dictate the style. Now, that doesn't mean, in this case, I've had to say, okay, I'm going to try this. But I will say this, like if you look at my work, the one I just did or the one you mentioned, it's not that different than my wildlife. I mean, it's still the same. I'm still painting the same exact way. I'm using different thought processes so that the styles can be sharper. They can be sharper, especially. I think one of my biggest problems when I first got here, and it still is somewhat, is I tend to think in terms of oils. So I think of that fuzzy, smoky look that Rembrandt would get. And it's kind of funny because when you're painting in oils, you have to work hard to get that look.
Huh.
What I've had to do is work hard to break that because I still tend to do that. I still tend to make things too soft and too yummy looking almost, too, you know, rather than sharp and bold and direct and illustrative in that sense. And that's been a huge challenge for me. And I'm still, I've had to discard a lot of the digital brushes I've used that are sort of mimicking that old oil style. And I've taken on much sharper brushes, which has helped a lot, you know, like... that one you mentioned with the President Obama on the cover, that was one where I was really starting to work with these sharp-edged brushes that give a clarity and it's just an interesting kind of difference. Tools can make a huge difference, but the technical, artistic side of it, I don't really think that much about it. It's kind of the same old thing. It's like I use reflected light, I use the same kind of all this. One of the things I love about having the opportunity to work here is that I get to draw on all of the years that I developed reflective light and making something look almost photographic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's paid off, you know. But now I am using, as you put it, I'm using digital work. I can use a lot more photographic textures, stuff like that, because of the speed issue. You know, if I only have 2 days to do something, you really don't have a choice. Basically my attitude is I will use whatever I have to.
Yeah.
I don't really care because it's not about me. It's not about my work. It's about, does the image work?
Yeah.
Does it fit the purpose?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, fascinating stuff. I'm sure we have many more years of happy collaboration before us, and it really is a pleasure to work with you, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing for us. So thanks for sharing.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
It's time for today's last word.
What is one of the best things you can do for your son? I spoke a couple of weeks ago about how important it is that we as parents regulate our son's use of media and zeroed in particularly on their consumption of violent movies, television, and video games. But there's another aspect of this issue we need to be vigilant to. Another stealth missile in the media aimed at our boys is sex. We must be defenders of our sons' purity in a world where sexual impurity is everywhere. Today, the average age of a boy's first exposure to pornography is 11. And what's available on the internet is far worse than at any time in the past, and it's far easier to access. Almost half of boys between grades 3 and 8 have visited adult websites. In his book, Bringing Up Boys, James Dobson wrote, "Porn and smut pose an awesome threat to your boys. A single exposure to it by some 13 to 15-year-olds is all that is required to create an addiction that will hold them in bondage for a lifetime. It's more addictive than cocaine or heroin." That was one of the conclusions drawn during the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography, on which I served. It is known by those of us in the field of child development that the focal point of sexual interest is not very well established among young adolescents. It can be redirected by an early sexual experience, wanted or unwanted, or by exposure to pornography. That's the end of the quote. In other words, that early exposure can distort the normal channels of stimulation by the opposite sex. Of itself, that sex stimulation is designed by God, and it's wholesome when it's used properly. But when someone is exposed to pornography, particularly at an early age, it can become distorted and perverted. Dobson explained, many men who have succumbed to these perverse sexual appetites have traced them to the dawn of their adolescence. Pornography is horribly degrading to women especially. God intends our sons to grow up to be protectors and providers for women. If a boy becomes ensnared by lust, it takes his mind 180 degrees opposite his being able to successfully fulfill that calling. Talk to your son. In his book Future Men, Douglas Wilson wrote this, "Fathers must assume that a difficult sexual struggle is occurring in their son's lives. A father must talk to his son and teach him. The teaching must consist of more than, yeah, I had this problem when I was your age too. The teaching must be grounded in the Word of God. What does the Bible teach about lust, fantasy, and so forth? A father should check with his son and not wait for his son to ask. Further, he should check periodically and regularly. Every son needs guidance and accountability from his father in this area. If we do our part, we can go a long way to giving our sons one of the most priceless gifts he could possess, a clean conscience." James Dobson wrote this, "An unsupervised kid can get into more mischief in a single day than his parents can straighten out in a year. Considering how the world has changed, it is doubly important to build relationships with boys from their earliest childhood. You can no longer rely on rules to get them past the predators in the wider world. It still makes sense to prohibit harmful or immoral behavior, but those prohibitions must be supplemented by an emotional closeness that makes children want to do what is right. They must know that you love them unconditionally and that everything you require of them is for their own good. With all the temptations buzzing around our kids, simply saying no 1,000 times creates a spirit of defiance. We have to build bridges to them from the ground up." I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Philip Nice, Jeremiah Jacques, and Gary Dorning. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Mark Twain. Whenever you find that you are on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.